This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Today's show is the mental and emotional skills for dealing with cancer and life-threatening diseases. Hopefully you won't experience cancer, heart disease, or other life-threatening illnesses. Should it happen, you do need to be prepared. And even if it doesn't happen to you, sooner or later, it will happen to someone close to you, and you want to be able to help. There's lots of information on the physical aspects of these diseases, but what about how to take charge rather than becoming emotionally overwhelmed and devastated? Today's guest, 30-year cancer survivor and psychologist, Dr. Neil Fiore, who is author of the book, Coping with the Emotional Impact of Cancer. Dr. Fiore, welcome.
It's an honor to be with you.
You said in your book that getting a diagnosis of cancer is like a physical assault. How is that the case?
Shocks us physically, but it also shocks us mentally. It's just so hard to believe that this time it's you. And it's hard to comprehend because for the most part, people who are diagnosed with cancer have been healthy. Generally, the symptoms are minimal. There could be a little discoloration or a little bit of pain or a lump or something, but people who are diagnosed with cancer are primarily healthy. And this is a major point, because I emphasize to people diagnosed with cancer or any serious illness that the part of you that has a problem is less than 1%. In fact, probably less than 0.1%. So you must give energy and attention to the 99.99% of you that is healthy and is able to cooperate with medical treatment and fight the illness.
And we see an awful lot of people that kind of deny and put it off and could have had much better results if they'd caught it early.
Average delay time is about 3 months, but people shouldn't blame themselves because in many cancers it doesn't matter that much. In fact, we know that even doctors who know the symptoms procrastinate or delay at least 3 months on average. I know I myself, though a psychologist, not a physician, I did delay at least 3 months before finding a doctor and feeling like there's something wrong here, and actually knowing what to do and who to see took a while to figure out. And of course, I was not expecting a cancer diagnosis.
You have a fascinating statistic that in 1961, only 1 in 9 doctors told a cancer patient that they had cancer, whereas now virtually all doctors do. How has cancer treatment changed since you had your diagnosis more than 30 years ago?
Well, I think one of the amazing things is that so many women have come out to talk about breast cancer and other cancers, and so many famous people have talked about it. They've removed a lot of the stigma. So people are much more informed these days, and the cancer survival rate has gone from 45% in 1970 to 66% in 2007. So an amazing change in survival rates, in part because people are coming in earlier. There are many more treatments and incredible advance in chemotherapies that are curing up to 90% of some cancers, 80% of some others. On average, it's 66%. So it's really important to be looking at survival after cancer and being fully alive after a cancer diagnosis.
Now, that 66% figure means that two-thirds of people who get a cancer diagnosis are going to still be healthy 5 years later?
That's right. That's right. They're going to be healthy. They're going to be cancer-free. And also, when you include cancers that are contained and cancers that are held in remission, the percentage is higher. And remember that in many cancers, the survival rate beyond 5 years is 80 to 90%.
That's wonderful news.
Yes. People are coming in earlier. People are more informed. The stigma about cancer is lower. We know and see famous people who speak about their cancer and who are alive today, living with it. We see people on television shows like Good Morning America, and we are able to see someone in some programs where they have veteran patients or survivors who are matched with the newly diagnosed person. So you see someone with your diagnosis who is getting the treatment, who got the treatment that you got, and is perfectly fine and healthy 2 to 5 years later. That has a great impact on the psyche.
And that's one of the places where you're such a wonderful role model, in that your diagnosis was, quote, terminal.
Yeah.
And here it is 30 years later, and your picture looks like the picture of health.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you know, I was healthy at the time as well. I was 32. I was very active in skiing and tennis and jogging and so on, socializing. And it was quite a shock to be told that I could be dead by the age of 33. So I didn't deny that as a possibility, but when the doctor said we've scheduled surgery for tomorrow morning, I found myself saying, no doctor, surgery is not scheduled for tomorrow. I haven't talked to my family, and I haven't gotten a second opinion and a third opinion. And he said, some people are afraid of dying, including me. And I said, I'm not afraid of dying, but I'm afraid of what your fear of cancer would do to me.
And this is the core of your message, that if you don't take charge, the doctors are going to take charge, the old captain of the ship.
Yeah.
And the patient really needs to, I don't even like the word patient, but you need to take charge and really call the shots, hire and fire the doctors, and ask a zillion questions.
I would say that you really need to participate, because the doctor will assume everything is fine. If you're not saying anything, it's like you're just going to get the regular protocol, and they don't know what your values are. They treated me like I was dying, and I had testicular cancer, which was the same as Lance Armstrong's.
Mm-hmm.
And they assumed that I would be dead, so they weren't thinking about a sperm bank and getting ready for living and possibly having children, which we now know Lance Armstrong was able to do. So they weren't thinking about that at all. I had to discover that on my own. And that's what I mean, that they don't know what your values are.
And they have a very different agenda, which is keeping you alive as many minutes as possible, as opposed to quality of life issues, which we have.
Yeah. So when another doctor said to me, I'm responsible for your life, I looked at him and I said, no, doctor, you are not. I am the one who will deal with the benefits and consequences of any treatment. I am the one who must make that decision. I consider you an expert, and I want to hear your knowledge, but I am the one who will decide you are not responsible for my life.
And we assume the biggest fear when you hear a cancer diagnosis is that you're going to die, but do you say that there are bigger fears than that?
There are certainly fears of being out of control. There are fears of crippling treatments. There are fears of unnecessary treatment. And certainly there are other illnesses which are much worse than cancer and much less curable. But we still have a kind of primitive fear of cancer. And we have belief systems that are just not accurate. For example, we hear people saying it has spread to the lung and it has spread to the lymphatic system.
Mm-hmm.
I've always had a great respect for the body, and so when they told me it had spread to my lung, this concept actually saved my life. I said, no, doctor, my lung filters the blood. My lung is holding the cancer. It is filtering the debris in my blood. It has captured 2 tumors, and it is a calcification around the tumor. The body's own defense system is around the tumor, so the center part of that tumor is the cancer. All the stuff around it is your body fighting it. So I always had this positive view of the body. And that saved my life, because I said, my lungs have filtered the blood. I need something that goes into my bloodstream. It's not in my lymphatic system. The lymph nodes hold debris and toxins and cancer cells quite often, in some cases, for decades. So it's not that cancer is strong and your body is weak. And for some reason, I just never bought that concept. And when I argued with my surgeon, who just wanted to cut out the bottom part of my lung, I said, no, I need something that goes into my bloodstream. I need a chemotherapy. And he said, you have a point there. At which point I pounded my fist on his desk and said, I want chemo today.
So we have an image of the body as very active and a partner. When the lungs filter out the cancer and form the calcium deposits around it, what happens to that next?
It's held for as long as the body can hold it. We need surgery in most cases, I guess, to remove the tumor load, to remove the amount of tumor that the body needs to fight. We may need radiation or chemotherapy to further reduce it. And then ultimately, my belief is that the body routinely mops up what they call microscopic foci, the microscopic bits in our cells. The human body produces billions and billions of cells every year. Some of them are confused. Cancer cell is a confused nucleus that does not recuperate after being hit with radiation or chemotherapy, but the normal cells grow back, like the normal hair grows back. But the body routinely mops up confused cells and gets rid of it, and we have to respect that. I have some slides that I present at Cancer Survivor Celebrations, which is the first Sunday in June, and we fought to get that because so many people are surviving cancer now that we need jobs and we need insurance, and we have to fight discrimination against the cancer diagnosis. So in these slides, it shows the white cells that look like fuzzy cotton balls all surrounding a cancer cell. And then the next slide shows a dead cancer cell with one white golf ball, white immune system killer T cell standing over the skeleton. The next slide is the dump truck, some macrophages. These large cells come in and devour it and remove it. And people applauded those white cells. And the question then becomes is, how can I get more of those white cells? How can I improve my immune system? And I'd like to talk about that in a moment after I hear your...
Before we leave the mopping up operation, it's not only the lungs filtering debris, but it's also the lymph nodes are capturing cancer cells and holding them for the macrophages to come in and dispose of the cancer cells. So we often think of lymph nodes as this horrible problem when it's actually the garbage disposal helping us out.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, if you have a swollen lymph node, that means that particular lymph node is working on dealing with some kind of infection, and it's working for you. You don't automatically cut it out. It's working. Yeah. And wherever it is, so it could be in the lung, but your body's immune system, which includes killer T cells and B cells and the macrophages, which are kind of the dump trucks, they use chemical processes to dissolve and remove cancer cells and other debris and other infections. They're going to be working for you all over the body. I have on my website, which is neilfiore.com, my name spelled NEILFIORE, and that's F as in Frank, neilfiore.com. Under free articles, there's a list of the five things that you might do to improve your immune system to make more energy available to your body so that your body can work with medical treatment, perhaps heal faster from surgery, and perhaps not only increase the quality of your life, but possibly the quantity of your life. And I'd just like to mention a couple of those now.
So the first one is?
The first one is to express your emotions. Now, there's a lot of controversy about that because a lot of people are afraid of so-called negative emotions. In fact, some books have been written about it. And I've never thought that there was a negative emotion. They are valid emotions. In fact, I'm now backed up by research because we know that people who tend to be stoic or try to act positive, denying their difficult emotions of depression and anger, those are the ones who don't do so well. In fact, I have a section of my book that says, being a good patient may not be good for you. Because the ones the doctors and nurses said were good, those are the ones who didn't do so well. But the ones who were the bad patients, the ones who were angry and expressing their emotions, those are the ones the doctors thought were bad. They were the ones who survived and the ones who did better. We now know from other research that the people who express these strong emotions verbally, physically, and in writing, writing at least 15 minutes a day, or going to a therapist or a chaplain, writing these feelings out, getting them out of your gut, process them through your brain and get them out on paper or onto the computer, improves your immune system. In fact, I was involved in this research with melanoma patients. The people who expressed anger and depression had significantly more white cells literally at the site of the tumor. They had significantly smaller tumors. And if you know statistics, these both were significant at the 0.001 level.
Mm-hmm.
Highly significant. This is not an accident.
Well, I would say that it's not just expressing the emotions, but using the expressing the emotions to work out a problem. Archie Bunker can express emotions all day long, and it's not going to help him. But people who are using it to sort out their feelings and come to terms with what they're going through.
If you look at James Pennebaker, James Pennebaker has been studying this for over 30 years. The people who write about their emotions express their emotions. So I don't think you necessarily have to figure them out. I don't think you need to be psychoanalytic about it. It's just get them out, dance them out, write them out, draw them out, sing them out, sing the blues, but get, express these emotions.
So that's your first one. What's your second one?
The second one is to make yourself safe with you. Now, how do you do that? And why do that? If you're criticizing yourself, if you're scaring yourself, if you're threatening yourself all day long, you're going to evoke a lot of stress hormones. That gets in the way of healing. That takes energy away from other coping. So I want to make myself safe that regardless of what happens, I am on your side. Regardless of what happens today, regardless of what they say, regardless of what they think, no matter what, I will not abandon myself. It's a little bit like holding a child who's crying, a child who may be colicky or sick, and you're holding the child over your heart, over your shoulder, and you're patting the child on the back, and you're saying, yes, 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 I'm with you. I'm with you even though you're sick. Even though you have these emotions, I can be with you. You are connected. You are not alone, and your worth is safe with me. There is an adult person, mature person, who can speak up for you and stand up for you. Regardless of what anyone else says, regardless of how much it hurts, I'm on your side. You have solid worth. Your worth is safe. At the end of the day, I will not let this ruin our sleep. I won't let it ruin our night. I won't let it ruin our weekend.
So it's being a very nurturant, protective parent and parenting yourself.
Yes, it is. It is being a protective, compassionate parent who also, I think, is also providing some kind of leadership, a positive expectancy, the kind of thing that a parent does when they're teaching a child to walk, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you look at that child taking his or her first steps and you communicate in that look, you're going to make it. Even though you fell down and you hurt your head and you cried, you have all of the ability to cry out your emotions, to live through the pain, and also to see the motivation come to you to stand again on your own two feet, to reach for something. You're going to make it. You're going to get through this. You're going to stand on your own two feet. You're going to run. You're going to ride a bicycle, maybe horse. You're going to fly in a jet plane. You're going to make it.
Well, if we keep going, you'll be an astronaut. So the third one is?
The third one is to go from worry to wonder. So a lot of people have asked me at various book signings for coping with the emotional impact of cancer. I keep forgetting to mention the book. Coping with the emotional impact of cancer, become an active patient and take charge of your treatment. They've asked me, well, what about this imagery that we're supposed to use? Some people have said, think of aggressive images of like sharks eating hamburger or something like that. And I always said that sounded like a lot of work. Not only that, I've heard people worry that they didn't do it right. And putting a lot of burden on your conscious mind, what I call the arrogant, lonely struggle of conscious or ego. And it's probably more effective and a lot more relaxing to go from worry to wonder. Do not hold that worry for more than 5 seconds. In fact, tighten your jaw, tighten your fist, take a deep breath and hold it, and exhale, and then open your fist and release, and give that energy over to your body to work for you. breath, pull in your stomach, tighten your muscles, tighten your fist, tighten your biceps. Exhale and release and go from worry to wonder. Wonder what your body is doing for you, but you get out of the way. Someone wrote, you don't have to tell a killer T cell what to do. You don't need to be so arrogant in your conscious mind to tell this cell that has been around for millions of years how to work. Just get out of the way.
So when people get in worrywart mode, which is very common, you would try to get them into a more meditative or relaxed state and then shift to this sense of wonder.
Yeah, staying in a relaxed meditative state, of course, is extremely useful. But I'm saying this is something you can do in 5 seconds. You can do this in one breath. I've had some remarkable results with people healing from surgery, dealing with chemotherapy, because they did not stay stressed or worried for more than 5 seconds without using the natural ability to exhale. And when you exhale, you are communicating to the mind and body. The human brain has decided it is safe to exhale. It is safe to sit still. It is safe to begin to shut off the stress hormones. And in most cases, within 30 seconds, the stress hormones are back to normal. And that is one of the most significant things in improving healing, is to reduce the stress hormones. So it's hold your breath, tighten your fists, tighten your muscles, and then exhale. And if you're doing that several times a day, within a couple of weeks, you will have conditioned yourself so that whenever you begin to get stressed or worried or tighten your forehead, you begin to exhale. And when you exhale, you shift over to parasympathetic nervous system, the peaceful relaxation response.
And it also gets you doing something physical to change that obsessive compulsive pattern that people get in when they're in that worrywart mode.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I define anxiety as being stuck energy, because you've created a picture of the past, what you should have done, or the future, what may happen in the future. And your body can't get there, because those are fantasies, those are not real. But once you do this now, all I can do now is take a deep breath and hold it, tighten my muscles, exhale, and my mind is focused in the present. And you go from anxiety to excitement and effectiveness. So the energy is no longer stuck, because the mind is now with the body in the present. In fact, I'd like to give your listeners just a little exercise. I call it three-part breathing. Again, these are on my website. This one is under centering. It's called centering exercise under free articles or articles and resources. And that the website is neilfiore.com, N-E-I-L-F-I-O-R-E. So you inhale, hold your breath, pull your navel to your spine like in Pilates, tighten your muscles, curl your toes, tighten your biceps, your fists, and then you exhale completely and float down into the feeling of the chair, the floor, or the bed holding you. Inhale, hold and tighten. Exhale away thoughts about the past. You might let go of old issues and have a vacation from the past. Your next breath, again in three parts, inhale, hold and tighten. Exhale away thoughts about the so-called future. It doesn't really exist. Bring your mind in from the future. And in your next breath, inhale, hold, tighten some muscles, and then release, exhale completely, and float down into the feeling of the present moment. Accept the support of the chair or the bed, the floor, the earth, with a sense of gratitude in this moment where it's relatively easy to be here, and your muscles begin to acknowledge that there is an outside support. It is safe to let go. It is safe to sit still. And you are shutting off the stress hormones, and you're bringing your mind into the present. You're getting rid of both anxiety and stress.
And you're learning self-hypnosis, and you're totally in control of the hypnosis.
Uh-huh. It is a form of meditation or hypnosis, uh-huh. Self-hypnosis, right.
We're talking with Dr. Neil Fiore, who is a psychologist in private practice in the Berkeley, California area, and author of Coping with the Emotional Impact of Cancer, as well as several other books, Conquering Test Anxiety, Awaken Your Strongest Self, and The Now Habit, and on top of that, several CDs. And Neil, you're also a top executive coach and a professional speaker.
Yes, I work with several coaching clients around the world. some as far away. I'm in Berkeley, California, but some as far away as Dublin and Israel and London and New York, of course, and Ohio. Yeah, we work on moving forward with goals and so on, especially around issues of procrastination and optimal performance and productivity.
I'm curious, in the executive coaching, is the focus usually on the individual executive or on the company as a whole?
It's usually on the individual executive or the manager or the law partner. It's usually on the individual first. And we're teaching effective self-leadership skills. So Awaken Your Strongest Self is really a manual for putting your higher brain and uses neuropsychology to understand the workings of the human brain, which is in the human forehead, the ability to choose to show up as opposed to the inner conflict between you have to, but I don't want to. Now, that applies to the current book, Coping with the Emotional Impact of Cancer, in that, remember, I had to fight to get chemotherapy. I had to argue with the surgeon. He wanted to do an 8-hour operation to take out my lymph nodes when there was no evidence of cancer in the lymph nodes. But that's what the research said. The research said, we improve your chances from 10% to 30% if we take out all your lymph nodes. I said, it's not in my lymph nodes. Plus, that research is based on people who are older than me. That research is at least 10 years old. Those people are not as healthy as I am right now. I don't need that surgery. What I need is chemotherapy. I had to argue to get it. And because of that, because I had lower stress hormones, because I fought to get it, because I was choosing it and demanding it, I did not have any side effects from chemo for the first 2 months. So a few years later, when I was working with cancer patients, I was always shocked initially. I was naive because they were saying, I have to get chemo, but I don't want to. I'm afraid of chemo. I have to.
So many issues I want to talk about here. One is staging, in that you've got radiation, you've got surgery, you've got chemotherapy, you've got alternative therapies, and whatever doctor you're talking to and his specialty or her specialty is what you're most likely to hear as the recommendation. How does a patient make sense out of where do you start in the approach?
I would prefer it if the family doctor took over and helped the patient to decide. These days you can go online, you can go to NIH.gov, National Institutes of Health.gov. You can go to NCI, National Cancer Institute, NCI.gov, GOV. And you can look for clinical trials and see what's going on. These days, a lot of that information is shared regardless of how small the hospital. Most doctors have access to what's being done in the major centers around the country. But that's a difficult one to answer. And that is based in part on your feeling about the doctor, your review of what the possibilities are, what makes sense. I was offered radiation because there was nothing proven at that time. In fact, the chemo that I got on was experimental. But it made sense to me because I knew that my lungs were filtering the blood and I wanted to get something into the bloodstream. So that's one of the reasons why I turned down further surgery. But I certainly would have preferred if my family physician were there to help me with that. He was not. He turned everything over to the head surgeon. Because now I was a cancer patient. And that's what they did in those days. And to some extent, these days, they turn it over to the oncologist. Yes.
So the alternative probably is getting several opinions and not being shy about asking for a second, third, or even a fourth opinion.
Exactly right. And when there are several options like radiation, surgery, chemo, there's at least three second opinions there, right there. Plus, there's nutrition. What can I do with nutrition? Not necessarily to fight cancer at this point, since you already have cancer, but to cleanse your liver, to increase the amount of vegetables and nutrients, antioxidants in your body, things that are going to work with your chemo and make your liver and your body stronger. I, for example, eliminated red meat from my diet for over a year. I ate more fish and I tripled the amount of vegetables. So I got on a healthy diet real fast because I knew I was going to be asking my body to deal with a lot of strong medicines. I redefined chemotherapy as a strong medicine.
I think part of the message is that we're always asking ourselves questions, and a lot of times, particularly early in the process, we're asking questions like, why is this happening to me, and how could God do this to me? And you're saying those are the wrong questions. We need to ask questions like, how can my nutrition help me get stronger? How can I produce more white blood cells? How can I help my body?
Yeah, in my book, Coping with the Emotional Impact of Cancer, I deal with people's belief systems, because I've heard a lot of them that are counterproductive, and a lot of them have to do with why. And as you just suggested, my focus is on what can I do now? How can I do it? How can I improve my chances now that I do have it? So I don't want to do a lot of philosophizing or theorizing or guessing about why. I just know that this time it is me, this is what I'm dealing with, and I want to focus on how do I clean it up, instead of why did you spill the milk? How do we clean it up? What can we do now? So now is a big word in my mental vocabulary. What can I do now? What do I know now? So this is the reality of today. So I want to embrace reality as it is, and that I am human. And that's a big one for a lot of people. It's hard to believe that I am human and vulnerable and could die. In fact, will die. And one cancer survivor at a cancer survivor celebration said, there are the initiated who say, when I die, and there are the uninitiated who say, if I die. Well, that's a big one, because psychologically you're dealing with an acceptance of yourself as a human being. I'm no longer a god or a special child. I am human. I'm part of the humus.
And everything we're talking about with cancer applies to heart attacks and other life-threatening diseases and coming to terms with your own mortality.
Yes, and I think more importantly, your own vulnerability. I will die, and if I'm going to die, as the doctor said, in 1 year, to the age of 33 for me, then I'm not going to live that last year in fear and following doctor's orders. I am going to be taking charge of what I can. Not everybody wants to do that, but there are ways of having friends and family and having ways of asking questions. And one of the things I have in the book, Coping with the Emotional Impact of Cancer, is how to ask questions, what questions to ask, how to talk to your family. So basically what you have in this book is a psychologist and a cancer patient, a cancer survivor, leading the patient and the family through the process, through the diagnosis, dealing with the beliefs that come up, dealing with the stress, the depression, and, if necessary, dealing with the final stages. As I say in the beginning of the book, though most of you are going to survive cancer, still, if you're worried about dying in pain, you may want to read the last chapter, which is the way in which we cope with those issues.
We'll get back to Dr. Fiore in a moment. Note how old you feel now. You will soon feel a lot younger after hearing Dr. Bricky. That's how I'm usually introduced when I give a keynote address. We're brainwashed with limiting beliefs about aging. As America's preeminent anti-aging psychologist, I bring good news for a change in how you view aging. And I do it with a good helping of humor. In short, I help audiences learn the mental game for living longer, healthier, and happier. But I'm not satisfied with people just acquiring information and having a good time. I have people adopt healthier beliefs on the spot and lock them in for lifelong benefits. And when I do a keynote or a seminar, I also like to stay and do breakout sessions, consulting, and individual coaching at no additional cost. When your organization or business needs a speaker, have them check out my demo video at anti-aging-speaker.com. That's anti-aging-speaker.com. And give me a call. My phone number is on all my websites. And now back to Dr. Fiore. You had been giving us three of the five recommendations. What's number four?
Ask questions. And that means writing things down. That means having family members there, and that's maybe. It could mean also that you tape record or use some device to record what the doctor is saying, because quite often, in the stress of the moment and dealing with surprises from the doctor, and also in perhaps a weakened state, it's difficult to process all of that. So you want to ask questions, you want to write questions out, you don't want to be holding on to doubts. found that I slowed the doctor down when he would rattle off a name and I would ask him to spell it, because I wanted the medical spelling so I could look it up. These days you can look all kinds of things up on the internet.
I hadn't thought of that as a wonderful technique for slowing the doctor down.
Yeah. So I want to express emotions. I want to write things down. I want to make myself safe. I want you to make yourself safe with you. Go from worry to wonder. And create a protective atmosphere, which is another way of cutting down on the stress hormone. Ask questions and create a protective atmosphere. Right now, the Earth's atmosphere is 14.7 pounds per square inch at sea level. That's a scientific fact. That atmosphere is thick enough to carry the sound of my voice, but it is thick enough to burn up the meteorites before they reach you. So most of the Earth's meteorites get burnt up before they reach us. So too with negative thoughts, so too with negative vibes, so too with your own concerns. They enter a bubble that is approximately 4 feet all around you with this thick atmosphere and slows things down. And that imagery helps you realize you can be calm on the inside and protect yourself from any negative suggestions. I'm so sorry to say that still I hear doctors saying to my patients, it's going to take 6 months to recover and you're going to have a lot of pain. I go, oh my God.
That's hypnosis.
Why would you say that's negative hypnosis when you're most vulnerable? Yeah, exactly right. So you want to protect yourself from that and say, well, it's really going to be interesting to see how rapidly I heal, how I'm going to surprise the doctor, and how I'm going to be pain-free or at least comfortable. And I prepare my patients for surgery and chemotherapy and radiation, and I always ask them to bring me back a surprise, because they're going to surprise the doctor at how rapidly they healed. In part because we've lowered the stress hormones, so they're healing more rapidly. They have less pain because they're not frightening themselves. They're going from worry to wonder in one breath. They have an improved immune system. So they're going in there at like the best possible situation for these kinds of procedures, and they always amaze the doctors. Doctor can't believe that the person is walking around after surgery. Can't believe that they hardly have any pain, just a little bit of discomfort maybe. We want to really protect ourselves in this protective bubble.
Two observations in what you're saying. One is you're encouraging people to not think of themselves as average. When the doctors talk about the statistics, you're thinking, well, those are based on a generation ago, and I'm younger and healthier than most of the people that were in that study, and I'm eating better and whatever else is to your advantage. And also, you're painting lots of very positive metaphors instead of the negative metaphors that we normally think of or hear on the news.
Yeah, very good, because numbers are very hypnotic, and doctors often use statistics incorrectly. So I was a new psychologist, having done research and worked with statistics and so on in order to get my degree. So I knew a little bit about the use of statistics, and when my doctor said, you have a 10% chance to live, I said, well, wait a minute. In all fairness, I did ask the doctor, what are my chances?
Mm-hmm. Well, we need a baseline, but we don't need it as a, this is what's going to happen. It's just kind of knowing the batting average
right.
of the batter.
Yeah, right. And the next day when I saw him, I was better prepared, and I said, doctor, don't ever say that to another patient. I would like you to be more scientific. You cannot apply a statistic to one person. You can apply it to the group. You can say this group, 10% survived. This group from 20 years ago with a population of 500, but you cannot apply a statistic to one person. And not only that, you want to say to that person, listen, don't worry about the odds, because we don't know about your personal odds, but you've got the best medical treatment available. Your job is to do what you can to work with this treatment.
I guess I'm feeling a little compulsive. I don't think we've done number five yet.
That's the protective atmosphere. So number four is ask questions.
Oh, okay.
Number five is to maintain that protective atmosphere, to protect yourself from negative suggestions, particularly numbers like statistics. Yeah, statistics and blood pressure.
a couple of good suggestions you had was you talked about how it's normal to go through some mourning as we deal with the change in our health, but 20 to 25% of people with cancer are going to get a major depression. And you point out that that's the same rate as for other problems like heart disease. But you say that depression is very underdiagnosed in cancer
patients. It's undertreated. So it's very appropriate for someone with cancer, especially if they're suffering from depression, which, by the way, can be brought on by some of the hormone treatments that are used, especially for breast cancer and prostate cancer. It's important then that these patients be treated by a psychiatrist, be evaluated for antidepressants, because cancer patients are undertreated when it would be very appropriate to have some kind of medication. But I think the attitude is, well, of course you'd be depressed if you're diagnosed with cancer. So it's not psychological. But in fact, it can be psychological. It can be affect the neural receptors in your brain. And so we may want some kind of drug that provides more serotonin to the brain, especially when so many of these treatments do affect our hormones.
And when we say undertreating, we're not just talking about medications, we're also talking about therapy or counseling.
Yes, therapy and counseling. And I have to say, when I first started doing this in the 70s, after I had survived the first few years, I was impressed that some places treated cancer patients in the rehab department, not in psychiatry, because the patients were saying, I think very rightly, I don't have a psychological problem. I have a real problem. I have a physical issue. And that's right. So you're not going to get patients to come in for treatment if, in fact, you're calling it a psychological disorder. It's not. It's a stressful time dealing with a physical issue. So the patients self-diagnose as, I have cancer. I've got a serious, real illness. And so we have to invite them into counseling and support. Quite often I start off with offering stress management skills.
Another really good point you made is to make sure you're in the right hospital. And by that I mean that they've had a lot of experience and your surgeon, if there's a surgeon or whatever the type of practitioner, has had a lot of experience doing that procedure. And your rule of thumb is that they should have had at least 200 cases of that operation, and when that happens, the mortality rates are 20 to 40% lower.
Yes, and there are places to find that information out, and some of it is listed in my book, Coping with the Emotional Impact of Cancer. But people can go online to find out, especially if it's a special kind of surgery, for example, a brain surgery, that you definitely want the experts who have had over 200 procedures. And in major hospitals, there are doctors who just do, you know, hundreds and hundreds of these. Recently, I had to have parathyroid surgery. I had some of that done by an expert. I think it took him less than 15 minutes, just a real expert. That's the kind of person you want.
And another suggestion you had was if your condition is very unusual, you're probably better off in a teaching hospital.
That's correct. In fact, I fired my first oncologist because he didn't talk to me. He felt the lump and said to the resident, feel this lump, this is cancer. That's how I learned about cancer. So I was completely shocked. You know, you mentioned initially the shock. I was just breathless. I couldn't believe I was being treated this way, aside from the cancer. So I fired him and I asked the head nurse, who is the best doctor in oncology? And I got one who, in fact, was connected with a teaching hospital.
And that's a great strategy, asking the nurses,
yes.
if you happen to be at the hospital anyway, because they're the ones that see it and know.
Yes. And the nurses, they deserve a lot of praise. I know one woman, the doctor was going to recommend a Halstead radical mastectomy. And the nurse very properly said after the doctor left, well, you are going to get a second opinion, of course.
And another way to ask it is, off the record, if it were you or if it were your husband or child, who would you choose or what would you do?
Mm-hmm.
And that takes them off the hook.
Yes, exactly right. Yeah, very good.
We're talking with Dr. Neil Fiore, who's a psychologist in private practice in Berkeley, California area. And I gather you still do therapy with clients, particularly cancer patients?
Yes. 25% of my patient load is with cancer patients or people with lupus and serious illness, fibromyalgia and so on, MS. But otherwise, I'm dealing with overcoming procrastination, optimal performance, stress management, and so on.
I think you ought to be teaching time management, too, with all the hats you're wearing and the several books that you've written.
Well, I do, of course, my book, The Now Habit, Overcoming Procrastination While Enjoying Guilt-Free Play, has a lot of time management skills in it. And my website, neilfiore.com, spelled NEILFIORE.com, and that's F as in Frank. My website has a number of things, including the unschedule. The unschedule says, first, schedule your sleep time, your play time, your Sabbath or Shabbat. Then you'll be motivated to start earlier on your work, but have high-quality play and high-quality work that'll cut down on your procrastination, increase your efficiency.
And are the CDs more relaxation, visualization CDs, or are they more instructional CDs? Or both?
They're both, but there are CDs, which is the Now Habit, complete volume of that, and also downloadable from Audible.com, AUDIBLE.com, the Now Habit. Awaken Your Strongest Self, it's the complete book. So these are books on tape or books on CD. And then my Hypnosis Network, hypnosisnetwork.com. Those are much more relaxation, but also geared toward productivity and mental toughness, showing up and working 2 to 4 times more efficiently.
And I'm envious of you that you've done some work with Milton Erickson, who's probably the greatest hypnotist that's walked the earth.
Well, we could do a show on Milton Erickson if you wish. I was able to spend several days with him and studied his books, memorized various scripts and so on. And I'm the former president of the Northern California Society of Clinical Hypnosis using Ericksonian methods. So I have many wonderful stories about Milton Erickson.
Well, you got a date then. Let's do it sometime.
Yes, that would be wonderful. And I appreciate this interview, a very informed, intelligent interview. Thank you so much. You've given your listeners quite a bit.
Commentary. Dr. Fiore gave us a formula for coping with life-threatening illnesses. The individual pieces of the formula aren't unique, but putting them together is. The formula starts with taking charge, asking lots of questions, and you choosing the hospital, doctor, and treatments. The formula calls for getting the feelings out, whether by talking with friends, family, healthcare members, therapist, writing it down, singing, or even screaming. As you're getting the feelings out, it's important to ask good questions. Why and philosophical questions like why me or how could God do this to me are counterproductive. Rather, you want questions like how can I grow more white blood cells? What nutrition would be best for me now? I love the movie title Waiting to Exhale, which is the way a lot of cancer patients feel. Dr. Fiore's formula includes taking charge of anxiety, which can be stopped in seconds by taking a deep breath, tightening muscles, and exhaling. You don't have to wait long to exhale. This simple skill can help you the rest of your life, whether you have cancer or not. Rather than fighting cancer like 12 rounds in a Rocky movie, Dr. Fiore suggests trusting your body to do what it knows how to do. Or as he puts it, you don't have to tell a killer T cell what to do. From there on, it's one step at a time, addressing the question, what do I need to do now? Dr. Fiore and I are both very big on the role of beliefs, questions, and metaphors. The one slight divergence I have with him is that just getting the feelings out can result in spinning your wheels if it isn't soon paired with making sure you're asking helpful questions instead of negative or philosophical questions. I agree that you don't have to figure out the emotions, you just need to get them out. But I've seen a lot of patients who rant and rave only to get stuck there. That's where counseling or psychotherapy is especially helpful. Dr. Fiore makes a good point that patients see cancer as a physical disease and often may be uncomfortable with psychological interventions. While it starts as a physical disease, and is primarily a physical disease, it ends up being a huge psychological challenge as well. Fortunately, people are becoming more accepting of psychological help. My experience is that most people with life-threatening illnesses, including cancer, who are in hospitals and nursing homes, are happy to talk with anyone who can help. The boredom, time on their hands, fear, and short time that they often get talking with other professionals conspires to make them even more receptive. Finally, I would underscore that the same principles we talked about with cancer apply to other life-threatening illnesses as well. If you want to hear how a leading cardiologist and cardiac psychologist approach heart disease, which is another life-threatening disease, give a listen to the show with Dr. Joel Ochner and Dr. Jerry Corafine that is archived on agelesslifestyles.com. That's A-G-E-L-E-S-S, lifestyles.com. They centered their approach on starting with dealing with stress and then addressing nutrition, exercise, and other lifestyle issues. You're listening to Ageless Lifestyles on webtalkradio.net and permanently archived on agelesslifestyles.com. For information on my books, Defy Aging, 52 Baby Steps to Grow Young, and my anti-aging hypnosis CDs, or personal coaching, or my keynote and seminar services, just go to notaging.com, N-O-T-A-G-I-N-G.com, or drbricke.com, D-R-B-R-I-C-K-E-Y.com. I'd love to hear your comments and suggestions. Send them to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. Until next time, this is your anti-aging psychologist, Dr. Michael Bricke, thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.